Well, good morning, everyone. So, this past week we learned something. We learned that apparently Home Depot has a program where every once in a while on a Saturday you can bring your kids in and they have a little construction project. They can build a little something and take it home. And apparently we were going to do that this week. And so with all my experience with tools and hammering and nails, that's, I forgot what you call those. No. I built something and I'm very proud of it. And I wanted you to see what I built. You guys are all in deep anticipation, I can tell. You don't even know what it is, do you? It's a microscope. They gave you this one little lens you put in here and you look down through it and you can see things. And Macon did most of the hammering and such, but I'm the one who came away with a blood blister on my finger. And I expect cards for my blood blister, okay? Some get well soon. We had a good time with that. We learned something. I'm going to go ahead and hand this off because I don't really need this on the stage. But yes, Macon had fun. It was fun. It was good. A couple weeks ago, we started a new series. We're essentially going through the book of Daniel. But one of the topic is to talk about ways in which Christians can be different from the world around us. How living as foreigners and exiles in a world that's not always friendly, our situation mirrors that of Daniel and Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego, living in a foreign land and trying to be faithful. And so for the first 2 weeks, we've gone through the first two chapters of the book, and we've talked about a couple things that made them different. For one, that they drew moral lines, and then they stuck to them, like when they chose to reject the king's food and instead eat the vegetables and water as a way of separating themselves from others and honoring God. And God, in fact, honored their decision and allowed them to do it. And then last week, we got into the story of Nebuchadnezzar having the dream and no one being able to interpret it. And then Daniel does. But when he goes to the king, he doesn't act as though he is so much smarter than all the others, but he sincerely gives God credit for his accomplishments and successes and says, "This is not because I am so smart, but because God wants you to know." And there's something about sincerity and understanding who is really in charge of the world and understanding that we're not playing a game of getting ahead, but of honoring God, that actually led Nebuchadnezzar to praise the God of Daniel. And that is an incredible accomplishment when you're talking about a pagan king. And so today we want to continue in this narrative, talk about what we can do that makes us different from the world around us. And we're just going to go into chapter 3 today and read another story. And it's probably more famous than even the first two chapters. It's one perhaps if you grew up in church at all, you've heard of. And even if you didn't, you may know pieces of it. Now, this is the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and the blazing furnace. And it starts out like this. We're in Daniel chapter 3 and verse 1. King Nebuchadnezzar, this is the king of Babylon at the time when the Israelites are living in captivity. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold 60 cubits high and 6 cubits wide. That translates to 90 feet high, 9 feet wide. So, large. An image of gold, and he set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. And then he summoned these satraps, prefects, governors. Actually, we don't even need all that information. I just wanted to start in verse 1. Okay, so he sets up this giant image. And a couple things we need to know. One is that image could be an image of Nebuchadnezzar himself, or it could be an image of a foreign god. And he has very specific instructions for it. Let's jump down to verse 4. Then the herald loudly proclaimed, "Nations and peoples of every language, this is what you are commanded to do. As soon as you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipe, and all kinds of music, you must fall down and worship the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And, just for good measure, whoever does not fall down and worship will immediately be thrown into a blazing furnace. Now that is some pretty serious threatening. So, it could be an image of King Nebuchadnezzar. Remember the last chapter, he had a dream of a giant image. An image of him that was is in gold and different metals. And maybe he's doing that, or maybe it is a foreign god. But either way, what we need to know is that this is really about loyalty to the empire. So just for comparison's sake, Rome used to do this. If you go back to the days of the early church, the Roman emperors, who felt as though emperors had connections to God that no one else had. In fact, emperors could be gods. And they would do these little tests, depending on how the wind blew politically, if there was concern that some people weren't being entirely loyal to the empire, or there was some concern that people thought that they were getting too, or if they thought people were getting too comfortable, or that they were being too lax with the people, then they would go around and they would force people to declare their loyalty to the empire. And they would do it by having them make a small little offering of like some incense or something. You know, burn a candle, essentially. And when they did that, they would go around to the different people. And Christians were often involved in these interactions because they were suspected of being disloyal. And they would have these problems because they would have to then worship the empire. They would have to declare loyalty to the empire above even their god. This led to persecutions. This led to the first martyrs. This led to people dying. And essentially what Nebuchadnezzar is doing here is a test of loyalty. Make sure everyone's on page with the empire. What we also need to know is that from a polytheist point of view, this is no big deal. In a world in which you believe there are many, many gods, every time Rome conquered another people, they didn't necessarily say, well, that god doesn't exist. They said, no, we'll just add that god to our collection. Now we got the gods of these people and the gods of those people and the gods of these people. And they expected reciprocally that those people would then accept the Roman gods. It's fair to think that Babylon would have been in a similar situation. And so when they say, we want you to sacrifice to our gods or on behalf of the empire, doing so for them was sort of no big deal, no issue, right? But for the earliest believers, it was. Because for them, the claims of God were very exclusive. You didn't just believe in another god, you believed in the one God. And a lot of times, one of the things that they asked Christians in Rome to confess was that Caesar is Lord. And the Christians would always come back, no, Christ is Lord. And you see where the conflict happens. And it probably just absolutely exasperated them because it's not that big a deal. You burn one little candle and you move on. But to the Christians, it was a big deal. And I think we're going to see that with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, it was similarly perceived. So this is a test of loyalty. This is something they thought was no big deal. But they were being forced to choose between gods and the empire, or between their god and the king of Babylon. And with that in mind, the question is, will they do it? Will they not do it? Will they continue to be different from those around them, or will they rationalize their sameness to the people around them? So we'll jump down to verse 8 real quick. At this time, some astrologers, those are the king's advisors, came forward and denounced the Jews. That's rather generic, isn't it? Your majesty, oh, they said to the king, Nebuchadnezzar, may the king live forever. Always how you address a king. Your Majesty has issued a decree that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipe, and all kinds of music must fall down and worship the image of gold, and whoever does not fall down and worship will be thrown into a blazing furnace. And Nebuchadnezzar's like, I know, I made that commandment. But there are some Jews, we'll name them, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who pay no attention to your majesty. They neither serve your gods nor worship the image of gold you have set up. And furious with rage, Nebuchadnezzar summoned Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And so these men were brought before the king. And Nebuchadnezzar said to them, is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the image of gold that I have set up? This should be a reciprocal relationship. I accept you, let you worship your gods, but you should worship mine as well. Now what are you doing? You're basically testing the loyalty to the empire. I have allowed you to come into my home, my palace, and serve me. You are in a better situation than all of your other Jews who have been left behind in absolute poverty. Now tell me again, are you going to refuse to make this small gesture? Now when you hear the sound of the horn and the flute and the zither and the lyre and the harp and the pipe and all kinds of music, if you are ready to fall down and worship the image I made, very good. But if you do not worship it, you will be thrown immediately into a blazing furnace. And then here's the kicker. And then what God will be able to rescue you from my hand? That was the challenge. And it sort of sets you up for what's going to happen next. Now all of a sudden, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego have to figure out how to answer the king who wants only a small gesture in order to keep living the life that they're living, which is not, honestly, not a real bad life. Out there living in exile in a world that's not friendly to them. But the king can't understand why they can only worship one God. The king doesn't understand that they have a higher loyalty. And so they are put in a place, as has happened all throughout history, where people are forced to choose between two very high priority things. In this case, between their God and the empire. What will they do? How will they respond? Will they continue to be different or rationalize their sameness to the world around them? And so they have to come back. They have to come back with some kind of a reasonable response to the king's question. Verse 16, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to him, King Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to deliver us from it, and he will deliver us from it, from your majesty's hand. And I love this part. But even if he does not, we want you to know, your majesty, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up. So, isn't that kind of feel familiar, right? When you go through a fire or a hard situation in life, you know that God is able to rescue you. Like, you believe that intellectually. God can rescue you from this. Is there anywhere in the Bible that promises he always will? And we all know that it doesn't promise us. Which leaves us in this weird situation because we know God is able, but we don't know if God is willing. And that can leave us without energy, can leave us without motivation, it can send us into the fire unprepared. And in this case, it could frighten them into giving in. But in the end, they don't, right? They tell Nebuchadnezzar, look, I know what you want us to do. I know our God is able to rescue us. He may or he may not. And if he does not, it won't change our answer. And that willingness that willingness to not give in, that unwillingness to change their minds, that unwillingness to rationalize being the same as everyone else in order to hold on to their life, is something that is different than any other kind of people. It must have exasperated Nebuchadnezzar to no end, such a small act that he required, and yet they won't do it. They're willing to risk their very life for this moment. At first, it's frustrating. Essentially, it's different than any other people. No one else is this stubborn. They are clearly different from any other kind of people on earth. And that is something that stuck in his mind. And honestly, if you go back to the early church, it's stuck in the minds of the Romans too. Because we had this repetition of history, this constant needing for empires to make sure that their people are loyal and to put them to the test and to wonder whether or not their religion or their empire will take first priority. And the Romans stumbled into this problem somewhere around the first, second century. And you know what ended up happening? By the time they got to the 300s, Christianity was the de facto religion of the Empire of Rome. There's something that had to happen. Because the people who lived, the people of the early church were so different from the other religions and all the other peoples that they had conquered, that they were willing to risk their life for this one individual God they believed in. And they acted differently. And they didn't think that poor people and weak people made the empire weaker. They actually thought that they were called to take care of them. And when weak babies and women were born, they didn't just throw them to the wayside. They took care of them. And sorry, I'm speaking from the perspective of Rome here. Let's clarify that a little bit, okay? And everything they did, when plagues and sickness happened, they didn't run away and flee. They stayed and helped people out. They risked their lives over and over again because their loyalty to their God was higher than their loyalty to the empire, to the point of giving their own lives. And that stuck in the minds of people, and it allowed the church to grow like wildfire. It's been said that the mission field is watered by the blood of the martyrs, because their stories are the ones that get passed around and convince people that there is something mighty different about the people of God. So how does the story play out? We jump down to verse 19. It says, "Then Nebuchadnezzar was furious with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego." Can you say that three times fast? Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego. And technically, I'm kind of a professional speaker, so I really should be able to do that. And his attitude toward them changed. He ordered the furnace heated 7 times hotter than usual and commanded some of the strongest soldiers in his army to tie up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and throw them into the blazing furnace. Keep going. So these men, wearing their robes, trousers, turbans, and other clothes, which I just picture being a real fire hazard, you know? I mean, they're just sort of flowing and kind of, you always picture them kind of long and oversized, were bound and thrown into the blazing furnace. And the king's command was so urgent and the furnace so hot that the flames of the fire killed the soldiers who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these 3 men, firmly tied, fell into the blazing furnace. And so, okay, you got this story of these martyrs, and they're giving their life to God. And it's a wonderful story. And honestly, we could stop here, and there'd still be a nice lesson. But when we are different from other people around us, we find that God often honors us in our desire to be different. This happened when Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego refused to eat the king's food. And had they come back skinnier, why, something would have happened. Either they'd have been rejected and sent home, killed, or who knows. But God honored them once, and he's about to do so again. Verse 24. Then King Nebuchadnezzar leaped to his feet in amazement. But I tell you about... Is that a blazing furnace? I did not know my sermon was so interactive. Okay. Wow. Okay. I told you, pagan kings being impressed by these different people is one of the themes of this book, right? Okay. Then King Nebuchadnezzar leaped to his feet in amazement and asked his advisors, "Weren't there three men we tied up and threw into the fire?" They replied, "Certainly, Your Majesty." He said, "Look, I see four men walking around in the fire, unbound and unharmed, and the fourth looks like a son of the gods." Now, that's curious, isn't it? Now, a lot of people like to talk about this and suggest that maybe the fourth one walking around was a pre-incarnate Jesus. I have no way of proving you wrong. I would say that's probably not, in its original language and its original context, it would have been understood by the earliest readers as being an angel. A son of God, in that sense, is an angel. That is, someone who belongs to the heavens. And that would have been the earliest understanding. Of course, we read the Old Testament from the perspective of the New Testament. And so people like to speculate those things. I don't know if that changes the meaning of the passage, but it's an interesting thing to contemplate. Either way, it would appear that God is with them in the fire. And that is something that's really incredible. Let's keep going a little further. Verse 26. Nebuchadnezzar then approached the opening of the blazing furnace and shouted, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants," what's he say? "Servants of the Most High God, come out, come here." So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the fire, and the satraps, prefects, and governors, and royal advisors crowded around them, and they saw that the fire had not harmed their bodies, nor was a hair of their heads singed. Their robes were not scorched, and there was no smell of fire on them. You ever been to a campfire? Do you come back smelling like campfire? Every time. They don't even smell like a fire has been anywhere near them. The incredibleness of this miracle is one that makes this story popular in vacation Bible schools and Sunday schools and everywhere we go, because this miracle is so impressive and so amazing. But one thing I'd like to point out, and that honestly has been pointed out long before me, but I think is something that's really kind of special about this, is that you notice that in God's miracle, He didn't keep them from being thrown into a fire. Like, wouldn't that have been the easiest way? Like, God just comes down and sort of changes Nebuchadnezzar's mind and says, "You don't have to do that anymore." Now, that would have been way easier than this whole song and dance of actually being thrown in, right? And one of the things that we often take from this, and I think is applicable, is that very often in life, as you approach fires and you approach problem seasons and things that you might have to go through, possibly even because of your loyalty to God above all else, for whatever reason, God does not always stop us from being thrown into the fire. God never promised to keep us from not going into the fire, and He never promised to keep us from the hardships and the consequences of the things that happen in this life. But one thing He does promise, and what we witness in this story, is that although they are thrown into the fire, God is with them in the fire. And so although we are not promised to avoid all difficulties and tribulations and trials, we are promised that God will be with us in those difficulties and those fires and those tribulations. And in a deep spiritual sense, at least, we will make it through. Because one day, when all is said and done, these momentary trials will be nothing in comparison to the eternity ahead. I'm sure that there are a lot of stories that if we took the time and went around the room, we could talk about people who went through a fire and how God was with them in it. For me, I'm still relatively young. I feel as though I've lived a very lucky life. Not lucky, but in the sense of blessed is what I really mean to say. But for me, the one time that I've talked about and will continue to talk about is the season that I went through a certain mental health crisis in my 20s, a time when I felt like I was in the fire in a way that I never had been. I was falling apart. I was told I should not go back to school and was not allowed to go back to school. I was in a season in which I had no idea what to do. And God didn't keep me from going through that fire. He let me go through it. And God, I believe, was with me in it. And he strengthened my faith and taught me about life and about faith and about my mind and my emotions in ways that I never would have possibly understood had I not gone through that. Prior to that season of life, I didn't know if I was happy, angry, or hungry. Like, there was so much to learn about myself. But having gone through that season, I came out of it on the other side. And because of that, I came to understand who God was and who I was in a way I never would have. And it allowed me to understand people who go through their own trials and their own mental health struggles, which, by the way, is a blazing, raging wildfire in our world today. Had I not gone through that, I would not be the minister that I am today. And every time I tell that story and every time I talk about it, I get letters and messages and people who contact me to tell me I never knew we could talk about that in church. God, I think, speaks to people in my own embarrassment more than he ever does in my accomplishments. Sometimes you have to go through the fire and know that God is with you because you come out on the other side changed. So I would encourage you that whatever you're going through, let God be with you in it. And you will come out the other side with a little bit more faith. But the last part of this, it comes down to verses 28 and 29. And Nebuchadnezzar, just like in the previous story, when Daniel revealed to him the dream, and at the end, Nebuchadnezzar gets up and he praises the God of Daniel. This is a pagan king, mind you. And it happens yet again one chapter later, verse 28. Then Nebuchadnezzar said, "Praise be to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego." I wonder if he realized that Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were worshiping the same God. I wonder if that even occurred to him, right? "Who has sent his angel and rescued his servants. They trusted in him and defied the king's command and were willing to give up their lives rather than serve or worship any god except their own." And now he has a new proclamation. "Therefore, I decree that the people of any nation or language who say anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be cut into pieces and their houses turned into piles of rubble." Okay, could have left that part out, but "for no other God can save in this way." No other God can save in this way. That's a pagan emperor right there. When we are different from the world around us and we allow God to be faithful and to be with us in those moments, when we don't try to avoid going through the fire, but to continue to go through the fire with our God, we often make an impression on the world around us. And the pagans, that's a strong word, the unbelievers who live around us may leave some impression upon them, as it always has in history. And so how is it that today or any day we can be different from the world around us? What lesson do we take from Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? And I guess if I could come up with a way of putting it into modern terms, I guess I would remind you to put God in a different category from every other priority in your life. I see things all the time that people have good intentions, and they say things like trying to prioritize their life. There's like, there's God here, and there's others second, and then there's me last. And I know that they mean well, because they put God in that highest position. Or they say things like, God, country, family. And they mean well when they do that, because they put things in priority, and they always put God at the top. I had a guy come to me one time, and he said to me essentially, he said, look, I think that being a good Christian and being a good citizen are the exact same thing. And I know he meant well. I know that he wanted people to do the right thing. And I know that half of our church works at or retired from the base up there, right? But if I'm speaking from a spiritual and biblical standpoint, what really strikes me is that in the Bible, it's never God and, it's always God only. And I'm not saying that those other things don't matter, but I'm saying the degree to which God should be separated from everything else in life is so high that we cannot even contemplate what that means. There's a biblical word, holy. We sing it all the time. Do you know what holy means? Separate, distinct, unique, like nothing else in its own category. And apparently when they sing to God in heaven, they sing, holy, holy, holy. And in Hebrew, that is the superlative. That's saying, not good, better, but best. Most holy. Holy beyond anything else. Separate, distinct, and different. When they gave the Ten Commandments, you know what the first two are? Have no other gods before me, and make no idols. Which are kind of, in a sense, at least from the modern sense, the same command. There can be no other gods. That is, there's nothing that is equal to God. He should be in its own category by himself. Then Jesus gets up and he makes a crowd mad one day when he tells them that by comparison to your love for your family, it would be considered, comparing to your love to God, that would almost be like hatred. Have you read that part? And I know I'm getting into tricky territory here, and I'm sorry, but I am presenting a biblical concept. It's not bad to love your country and your family. Those are good things, and they should be near the top of your earthly list. But when it comes to your all-time list, God is in a category of his own. That, like, if you were to list out your priorities, 1 through 25, 1 through 20 would be God. And your family and your country and everything else might begin at 21, maybe. What I'm saying is that all throughout history, people have been forced to choose between their God and something else. And those whose stories are still being told are the ones who chose their God. And you might not have dealt with that question at this point, and I hope you never do. But this is a repeated pattern of history. And it is something that people to this very day still have to deal with. God has to be in another category. In the Bible, it is never God and. It is God only. It's the first two commandments. It's not just that God is the top. It's that he's the only thing we can guarantee that we get to hold on to. All throughout history and around the world, people have been forced to choose between things that are unpleasant. In Rome, the Christians had to choose whether or not to offer this little sacrifice. They had to choose between their God or their empire, and loyalty to only one was acceptable. In the Middle East to this very day, people have to choose between their God and their family. Because the moment they become Christians, they are exiled, they are put off, they are rejected, they are treated as if they had died. And they are forced to choose between two very good things. and they have to choose God. And there are smaller versions of this too. If you're in high school, you may someday have to choose between your group of friends or living faithfully to the God that you claim to love. And you'll be put in those hard spots. Life has a way of doing that to you, of choosing between two good things. In your workplace, you might unexpectedly come to meet a person who makes you feel differently than your spouse has made you feel in a long, long time. And you will have to choose between that person who makes you feel in a way you haven't felt in forever, or keeping at peace your relationship with the God who gave everything for you. And you can't do both. At the tax office, you might have to choose between a few thousand dollars that would really go a long way in this season, or your peace with the God who loves you. And in some sense, we are all the time choosing between whether to put at risk our relationship with one holy God or some smaller, lesser thing. And the question is whether or not we will choose the one thing we know is greater and higher, or if we will give in and choose to be the same as the world around us and to rationalize doing the same things everyone else does, or hold to those things that truly make us different. And I hope we never have to choose between those high-level priorities, but if we do, I hope we're ready. And in the meantime, we need to work on choosing God over the small things. Why would you risk it? One of my favorite stories, and I will move on after this, but one of my favorite stories that I tell sometimes is one of several car incidents that Jen and I have been in when I was driving. There was one morning in Kansas, and we're just southern people. We don't know anything about the snow. But that morning, we were just sort of craving pancakes. Have I told this story in a while? I'm sorry if you've heard it. We were just really praying. There was this good breakfast place nearby. It was like a Saturday morning. This was before Macon came along. In fact, I think you were pregnant. Is that right? Yeah, okay. You were pregnant, and we just wanted to get us some pancakes from this local breakfast place. And we looked out the window, and there was some snow starting to come down. But, you know, we have four-wheel drive now. We can handle it. We're good. We get in the car. We go driving. We don't get, 400 yards from the house, maybe. And we turn onto this narrow little road, and it's covered in snow. We can't really see where the road ends and the ditch begins. So we just drive right down the middle of the road until a car turns in and is also coming down that road. So we do the polite Midwestern thing, which is where you kind of slowly get off to the side of the road and let the other car pass. Except in this case, I don't really know where the side of the road is. And all of a sudden, I get my wheel just a little too far over. And at that point, it was just sliding. There was nothing I could do about it. It just pulled me down into the ditch. And I realized in that moment that I had made a bad decision. That was the most expensive pancakes I never got to eat. Let me tell you, you claim insurance on this kind of thing, and, you know, it's not fun. And I realized that I put our financial situation in a not-so-great position. We had a baby on the way, and we had all this accident. And I chose to put all these things at risk for what? Pancakes that you can make for like 30 cents at the house, right? Sometimes we make bad decisions, and we choose to put at risk very important things to us for very small things. Sometimes we know and we perceive in our head that God is tops, but sometimes small temporal things get chosen instead. And by the grace of God, we have forgiveness for that. But we have to remind ourselves over and over and over again that we will constantly be put in a position to choose one or the other. Let's choose God. He is in his own category, far beyond anything else. A couple application points. I want you, one this week, ask yourself when you have risked your peace with God for something small. These are sins. These are temptations. These are when we give in times that it was completely not worth it. Have you ever cheated on a diet and gotten something that was just not as good as you thought it was going to be? Don't risk your peace with God for something that just isn't worth it. Number two, I want you to pray for people around the world who still to this day are forced to choose between God and something else very important to them, be it country or family, who have to, because of all the evil around us, choose one or the other. Pray for them, for their strength to endure that, because it's not easy to realize how holy God is and in his own category. And we too may someday be forced to choose these kinds of hard things. And number three, I want you to recall a time in your life in which God has been with you through a fire. Reminding ourselves of these things increases our faith. And it helps us to have faith when we go through fire that we will make it through it again. And it's important that we recognize when God was with us in the fire, when if someone had been able to look into your spiritual life, they would have seen a fourth man standing there. Because that person was God with you. And they brought you through the fire, and that made you who you are today. Recall one of those times in your life and thank God for being with you. I think that's essentially what I've got today, guys. Sorry I ran a little bit long. Let me say a prayer, and we'll go on this week. God in heaven, thank you for loving us as much as you do. Thank you for being so holy, for being someone who sent his son and chose us over all the glory you could have had forever. Help us, Lord, to always choose you, to put you in a category that is different from anything else in this world. Help us, God, to not give up on you for such small things. And thank you that we have forgiveness when we do make those wrong choices. God, you are a great and awesome God. And when we are truly different from the world around us, uncompromising even, it leaves an impression on those around us. And I pray that the best we might live in a way that leaves others glorifying our God. Because God, you deserve that praise. And only you. Amen.